Housing on Friday, March 8th, 2013, and we'll open up the work session on House Bill 2921. Colleagues, this is a bill that had been sent to our committee, but since the Health Committee is working on several other issues that are similar to this, we're going to send it on to the Health Committee. So,
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Who's doing it?
I need to do this. House Bill 2921 has no revenue statement. A fiscal statement was issued, and it has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. It appropriates $500,000 from the general fund to the Women, Infants, and Children program.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair?
Yes, go for it.
You know, I couldn't help but notice that the Health Committee is working on several other bills similar to this, so I'd like to move that House Bill 2921 without recommendation to the House Committee on Health.
Representative David Gomberg moves House Bill 2921 without recommendation to the House Committee on Health. Any discussion? Any objection? I could just do, we need to take a roll call? Better do it. Give us a roll call.
Debbie. Gallegos.
Yay.
President Gelser.
Aye.
President Jimenez.
Excuse.
Geyer.
Aye.
Representative.
Excused.
Representative
Whitson. Aye.
Vice Chair Gomber.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Chair Tomei.
Aye. Having received the required majority, this bill passes on to the Committee on Health. Is that right? Yeah. Thank you very much, committee. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2921 and open up the public hearing on House Bill 2980.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2980 has a revenue statement and no fiscal impact and a subsequent referral to tax credits. It extends the sunset on tax credits related to farm worker housing ownership, operation, and lending for construction or rehabilitative purposes to the year 2021, modifies language referencing farm worker housing to agriculture workforce or agriculture worker, changes name of farm worker housing facilitation team to agriculture workforce housing facilitation team.
Great. Thank you. Do we have a list of people who are wanting to speak? Oh, Representative Unger, please come on up. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. Members of the committee, thanks for having me this afternoon. For the record, my name is Ben Unger. I'm the state representative for House District 29. And I'm here today to urge you to strongly consider and pass House Bill 2980 out of your committee. A little bit of background about why this issue is important to me. As many of you may know, I grew up on a farm in Washington County, and my family has had a long history with migrant camps. And in fact, if my legislative assistant arrives here soon enough, I will show you. In this building, there's a photo of a historical photo that's been on one of our walls up on the fourth floor, if you've noticed before, of someone on one of the Unger Farms camps from 1967. And if you remember or have ever been to a camp or were at a camp in the 80s and saw what those buildings were like and what those facilities were like, I remember one of the very first times I went to a camp as a volunteer to help clean them up and get ready for the summer. It almost broke your heart to see how poorly treated the camps were, how in bad disarray they were. It wasn't even good enough cabins for a summer camp for a kid, much less for a place for someone to live for 3 months. And those experiences as a young child growing up really shaped my understanding of how we ought to treat the farm workers who help support the $5.3 billion industry that is our agricultural industry in this state. And so I come to you proud that the state has figured out a way to actually give the farm workers in our state an opportunity to live in that kind of housing that they deserve. And last month, or maybe it was 2 months ago now, in my district, Bienestar, which is one of the great nonprofits that helps to build farm worker housing, opened up one of their newest facilities, Juniper Gardens, in Forest Grove. And the opportunity, and they were nice enough to invite me to come out and speak. And the joy it brought me is hard to describe, because the difference between what we give these folks today versus what we provided to them 20, 30 years ago, it's astonishing. And these are houses where people actually can be proud to live in. They're houses that pull in so much federal support, private equity, that we couldn't afford to build them as a state without these added dollars. But the tax credit that's before you today is what pulls in, what's the number? $80 million of private and federal funds that support these workers, but also help support our local community and our agricultural industry. These folks, without these supportive housing, wouldn't be able to afford to live in the places where they live today. The average income for an agricultural worker in our state is just barely over $10,000. These houses are really needed. The vacancy rate at these places, there's a long, long list. I think a less than 1% vacancy rate at farm worker housing locations across the state. And I know that in my district, as we build more of these houses, and they're really treasured parts of our community, these are places that they're bright, they're attractive, they're places, again, like I said, where people can be proud to live in. There are opportunities for these folks to have stable lives, stable housing, so that they can be a stable part of our workforce for the long term. So, once again, this tax credit, not all tax credits are great. Some of them don't deliver what they're supposed to deliver. And you can ask the proponents of this tax credit. Even though this is something that's important to me, I was still skeptical that this money was well spent. They spent a long time convincing me that I was wrong and that it was well spent, and they did a great job, obviously, which is what brings me here today. But again, I strongly encourage you to support this credit for not only the workers that live there, but also for the entire agricultural industry and communities around the state. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions of this witness. Representative Gallegos.
I just want to point out, that was my father in that picture there. No, seriously. Seriously, I just want to thank you for your testimony. I think just share with the committee, too. I mean, I spent my last summer working in the fields when I was 17, and I lived in this, it was like a tent, and then, you know, the wooden frame and then a tent part. And so, I mean, the conditions that folks live in to do this work is horrible, actually. But the other thing, Representative Unger, if you could comment on, to me, this is not just a tax credit, it's an investment. And the return that the state gets, that the community gets in terms of local dollars, the produce that is sold locally in our markets, farmers markets, and so on. Could you kind of comment on that, sort of the economic impact that this investment might have?
Representative Tomei, Representative Gallegos, thank you for the question. It's pretty astonishing. So if you take Juniper Gardens, for example, that's 46. They're building it in two phases, this housing facility right outside, right in the heart of Forest Grove. They took $1.5 million in these credits, and they leveraged it with $3 million of rural development, federal rural development dollars. So what we really got for our taxpayer dollars was $4.5 million of investment with local nonprofits, local contractors, you know, jobs building these facilities, plus the fact that we're, again, bringing that federal money to local communities. So it really is an investment that's matched by private and federal dollars that really make it a deal. And one last thing for the record, Representative Gallegos, the photo was taken in 1967, so I'm suspicious that the kid in the photo is your father, but that might
be the case. Any further questions? Thank you very much, Representative,
you, Chair,
for bringing this bill to us. With that, we will call, are these first? I know who these are, but are these first before these? Okay, John McCully, Katie Fast, and Larry Kleinman, and Francisco Lopez. That's fine, we've got other people. Thank you. And thank you so much for coming today. Pardon?
Madam Chair, I think there was an introductory PowerPoint that Roberto Jimenez was going to present to the committee.
Okay.
If that would be okay for him to precede us?
Sure, that's fine.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I just want to remind folks that we have four bills we're going to be hearing today, and we've got an hour and a half, so I hope that you would take that into consideration and move things up a little bit. Go ahead. Just introduce yourself, please.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'm Roberto Jimenez, Executive Director of the Farmworker Housing Development Corporation in Woodburn. I represent the Agricultural Workforce Housing Coalition, which includes over 100 supporting organizations from around the state. We're happy today to support House Bill 2980, which with companion bills SB 323 and HB 2474 extends the sunset of the Farmworker Housing Tax Credit. A variety of tools and strategies are needed to create affordable housing opportunities in Oregon. The Farmworker Housing Tax Credit, renamed in HB 2980, the Agricultural Workforce Housing Tax Credit, to reflect accurately who it serves, has been a proven and effective part of the toolkit since 1989. The primary purpose of the tax credit is to help create decent housing for Oregon's agricultural workforce. Over the past decade, the credit has helped create more than 1,200 units of housing in 17 counties. The purpose of the tax credit. The legislature established the Farmworker Housing Tax Credit in 1989 to support development of safe and adequate affordable housing for the state's agricultural workforce. The tax credit is an essential, effective tool that brings us closer to meeting this policy goal. Oregon Housing and Community Service makes an annual allocation of credits. Community-based nonprofit housing developers and farmers are with eligible projects apply for the credit. About two-thirds of units have been built, of the units that have been built since 2001 using this credit are community-based, and about one-third are on-farm. A 2011 analysis by Oregon Housing and Community Services found that $23.9 million in Farmworker Housing Tax Credits was awarded since 2001, has produced a net total economic benefit of $271 million. The Department of Revenue estimates the 2013-15 revenue impact plus cost to extend the credit at $2 million. The credit has undergone extensive policy review in the past two legislative sessions. In 2011, we worked collaboratively with three agencies, Oregon Housing and Community Services, the Department of Revenue, and Oregon OSHA to respond to legislators' requests that we review and update the program. This work has been done. We're very pleased to have the support of the governor in recommending the extension of the sunset, as well as being included in the co-chair's budget. Your packet of materials includes additional detail. Who benefits from the credit? Most importantly, farm workers and their families benefit from safe, decent, affordable housing. Housing gives people an opportunity to build better lives. Farmers who participate in the program receive a credit to help offset 50% of the cost of building on-farm housing. They increase efficiency, production, and invest in a stable workforce. Nonprofit developers of community-based housing are better able to provide safe, decent, affordable housing in their communities. State resources are leveraged by federal grants and loans, as well as private investment. Local economies benefit from the economic stimulus of housing construction, as well as more stable local workforce. This is one of FHDC's properties in Woodburn, Nuevo Amanecer. To give you an idea of the kind of development this tax credit supports, Nuevo Amanecer is one. It's 90 units of farmworker housing, soon to be 130, and there are another 300 families on the wait list. through other funding sources and partnerships, we provide not just housing, but family and community support services such as early childhood literacy programs, after-school programs, summer enrichment, adult computer classes, English classes, driver's education, and much more. Safe, decent, stable housing in these services make a difference in the lives of residents. To take just one example, we're closing in on 100% graduation rate amongst high school age youth who live at our properties. We don't have enough safe, decent, and affordable housing for all of our agricultural workforce. We know that we're meeting only a small percentage of the needs statewide. This leaves families and workers sleeping in cars, under bridges, or in fields, where it means that growers don't have an available workforce. But the investment leveraged by this tax credit, children like the ones in the photo have the opportunity to succeed in school and life because they have a safe, stable place to call home. Another similar project is Canyon East in Madras. It was developed by Housing Works, a Central Oregon Regional Housing Authority, and opened in 2011. The project's funding included farm worker housing tax credit equity of $300,000, which leveraged $3.2 million in federal support from USDA. This tax credit keeps workers and their families out of unacceptable, inhuman living conditions like these. This is an on-farm project, not registered with the state, in Marion County. This is another project. This one's in Washington County. This mother and young children are getting water from a rusty barrel. We can and must do better in Oregon. This tax credit is an essential investment in the safety and well-being of our agricultural workers. In conclusion, there are three reasons why this tax credit serves an important public purpose and deserves extension. It helps provide a stable workforce to support our $5.3 billion agricultural economy. It leverages federal-private investment, resulting in net economic benefit to the state. It provides safe, decent, affordable housing for families who put food on our tables. Thank you for giving us time on your agenda, and we're here to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. We're going to move on to
Peter Hanley with CASA of Oregon, and I brought my son, David.
Hi, David.
And it's his 9th birthday. He was so excited to come down here and get the sunshine. I just wanted to add one of the benefits that we forgot to put in there, and I can't believe we missed it, is the fact that these USDA rural development projects come with rental assistance. So none of the residents pays more than 30% of their income. So if you're making $10,000, they pay $3,000 during a 12-month period. So that's a really big subsidy that we forgot to mention in it. Mm-hmm. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. We worked with Roberto and with Housing Works in Redmond to develop the Canyon East project that are up there. And so we do a lot of the work helping to bring the federal money into the state.
Great. Any quick questions?
One more comment. Yeah, it's what I was trying to get Representative Unger to comment on. And you don't have it up here. I mean, what I was trying to get at, what is the long-term preventive kind of benefit that this kind of investment makes with regard to health care? I mean, this committee is really becoming aware that housing is much more than just shelter and a building, but it really does impact the long-term health care and the cost of the state in terms of health care if we don't attend to it. So, you know, I'd like us to think about that kind of investment as well and economic benefit from taking care of these folks.
Yeah.
Representative Gelser had a question. Is this a current picture? Is this happening now?
Well, Chair Tomei, Representative Gallegos, this is Campo Azul. This picture was taken quite a number of years ago. The camp is still open. It's just been a really tough one for both the county and OROSHA to figure out what to do, because if you close it, where are they going to go? So that's always kind of been the age-old question. To answer your question, Alberto Moreno can help answer some of the questions regarding health benefits a little bit later.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Hi, thank you very much for your presentation. Do you have any numbers on how many families or units you've been able to use with this program and how many families or units are still needed?
Go ahead.
So I think in the presentation it's 1,200 units of housing.
Have already been completed?
Yes.
And how many are needed, would you guess? Does this just scratch the surface, or does it make a huge dent?
And Chair Tomei, representing Kenny Geyer, we estimate we've maybe done 2 to 5% of the need in the state. As far as migrant and seasonal farm workers go and their families, there's about 150,000 in the state. Mm. Year-round farm workers, somewhere probably between $35,000 and $50,000. Now, obviously, the year-round farm workers are making a little bit more because they're typically maybe got 10 months of work a year, so they're maybe up to maybe $16,000 to $20,000 a year. Mm. So we've pretty much just scratched the surface on it. Now, the 1,200 units is new farm worker housing units. We have renovated some older farm worker housing units using the credits in Milton Free Water and some other places around the states. And that 1,200 units then doesn't count all of the on-farm bed spaces that have either been newly created or built and are newly created or rehabilitated. And I don't have those numbers, but it's probably up around 3,000 to 3,500. We can get those numbers for you. The problem is OSHA used to administer the program for the first 10 years, and then when the legislature updated it in 2001, it was then moved over to Oregon Housing Community Services, and all of that data didn't get transferred with it. So we can't find a real good number on the grower side of things.
Okay, and one more follow-up question. You had some impressive, like the MADRS, I think, was a 10-to-1 leverage. 300,000 brought in 3.2 million. Do you have an overall number for those 1,200 units? What you've been able to leverage with the tax credit state?
You know, in my experience, it's a 10 to 20% leverage.
Yeah, very impressive.
And it varies by project. Some projects it's just been a smaller piece, and some projects it's been up to 25%. So it just kind of depends on the project need. So, and you know, the $80 million, it's leveraged well over the $80 million that we have in here, because that's going back just in the last, since 2001, over the last 12 years.
That's great. And then I was just going to add one comment.
Uh-huh.
I'm eager to hear Alberto's talk about health, and I appreciate Representative Gallegos pointing that out. And I would also just say for our education system as well, when you've got stability for kids in school and they're not having a change, and our efforts to meet the 40-40-20, there's a big, you know, a big gain there, in addition, of course, to the businesses, the farms that need stable, reliable workforce. So thank you for bringing this to us.
Chair, may I make one comment related to that? We have cited three clinics alongside the housing projects that we have developed. We have helped Virginia Garcia develop one in McMinnville, and then we've helped a couple other clinics around the state. We've helped cite some Head Starts close by. So we're constantly trying to work with different partners to figure out ways that we can work together and make sure we get this done in a logical way.
Great. Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now we'll hear from John McCulley, Katie Fast, and Larry Kleinman. Thank you for coming, and just identify yourself. And
good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm John McCulley, here representing the tree fruit industry. That would be the Columbia Gorge fruit growers in the Hood River, Wasco County areas, and the Blue Mountain growers in Umatilla County. These are producers of pears, sweet cherries, and apples. All of those crops need to be hand harvested. There is not a machine yet. They're working on it, but there's not a machine yet that can harvest those crops. And the family farmers I represent depend on a migrant and seasonal workforce to provide the skilled labor necessary to harvest those crops. The farm worker housing tax credit has been an incredible benefit, not only to the farm families, but to the workers' families who live in the housing during that harvest season. This is a very short, intensive time period, so it's very difficult for the workers to find stable housing for a 6-week period. And the housing that's provided by the farmers has been a very important component of this overall housing stock for farm workers. The tax credit has been used extensively in Hood River and Wasco counties. About 90% of the on-farm projects using the tax credit occur in those two counties, and I think you will find that it is some of the best farm worker housing in the state. We're proud of that fact. So we encourage you to approve this tax credit, send it on to the Tax Credits Committee where it can be reviewed with all of the others, and we think that it will fare very well when compared with other tax incentives in the state. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, Tom.
Hi, good afternoon. For the record, Katie Fast with the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation, here in support of the continuation of the agricultural worker housing tax credit. Interesting fact, Oregon is a top 10 producer of several agricultural commodities, and majority of those are hand-picked, and so labor is an important source for continuing that. We are also ranked top 5 in the nation in terms of employers that hire farm workers. So this tax credit is essential to meet the need for decent and affordable housing near and on the farms. Ag workers benefit from a safe and stable homes that the Oregon farmers provide. The communities benefit from economic activity, and our farmers benefit to having access, as John mentioned, for a short time, being able to bring the workers in and having housing to meet their needs and have them want to come to Oregon and come to these areas in the farm zone. When you put the benefits together, it's vital. This program's vital to the support of agriculture, plus the jobs that are created through the federal and private resources that are leveraged in the building of the projects. And so it's a great investment for the Oregon, and we ask that you continue it and pass it on to the Tax Credit Committee.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Larry Kleinman, and I'm the Secretary-Treasurer of Pineros y Campesinos Unidos del Noroeste, PECUN, Oregon's Farmworker Union. My written testimony is in your packet, and it is Friday afternoon, and as Chair, you have admonished us. You have a busy agenda, so let me just make a couple of comments rather than read my testimony. First of all, I think there's clearly been a compelling case made for continuing this tax credit, but I want to offer a point of personal reflection about it, which is that in hearing room E 20 years ago, I testified in favor of the initiation of this tax credit on behalf of PECUN. I had become Secretary Treasurer in 1988 and 3 years later was testifying for this. And as you've seen in the slideshow, and here we are in hearing room D, we've come a long way. As you heard, this tax credit not only is a great investment, but it is transformative for families and for the communities in which this housing is built. Lastly, I'll say that my colleagues here and I, the union and agribusiness, 20 years ago agreed on almost nothing. And when we came to this building, we were almost never on the same panel when we were testifying. Today, we still disagree about many things, but this is one topic on which we agreed 20 years ago, and we have agreed every year since, and we agree today. So I ask your unanimous support for this bill, and I appreciate your time and welcome any questions.
Thank you very much for coming to testify. Any quick questions here? Seeing none, thank you again.
Thank you.
Now we have Eduardo Arulgi. I'm not sure how to pronounce your last name. And Alberto Moreno, and that was Ben. Okay, great. Welcome, and if you just announce who you are, that would be terrific.
Yes. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Eduardo Angulo. the chairman and executive director of the Salem Kaiser Coalition for Equality. We are a community coalition of the organizations that serve our community throughout Oregon, including PECUN, the Farm Workers Union, CAUSA, the largest pro-immigrant rights coalition in the Northwest, Mano a Mano Family Center that serves the families here in Marion County, Latinos Unidos Siempre, our youth organization, Coalition students, Latino students from Willamette University, and most importantly, our parent organizing project that is helping build capacity in Latino and Spanish-speaking families in throughout Oregon. Just like Larry mentioned, and you asked us, Madam Chair, to be brief. That's Friday afternoon. I'm going to be brief, and I think that the representative, Kenny Goodyear, stole my thunder. With regard to our North Star, educational ambitions in Oregon, the 40-40-20. We have 60,000 English language learners, many of them that are sons and daughters or are farm workers. These children, the great majority of them, are American-born that live in monolingual Spanish-speaking families. We have an ambitious goal to get our children to be fulfilling this 40-40-20, get to graduate, all of them, from high school, get to a college degree. We need to include these children. I think the importance of having these children in safe housing, you could see, you saw the pictures of the presentation that Roberto did, and I think it speaks volumes. As we are all gathered together in behind our governor and Dr. Rudy Crew and Dr. Rob Saston in presenting a new Oregon that includes our English language learners. Most of these kids, sons and daughters of our farm workers. I am here today with the support of, we created the Oregon Alliance for Education Equity. It is a coalition of communities of color leaders and community organizations representing African American community, all the NAACPs, self-enhancement in. We have the APANO, the Asian Pacific Islanders organization, and we have all the nine tribes governments throughout the state of Oregon. We all came together because we want to be part of the solution in the issue that has to do with the achievement gap. So we are all in support of the renewal of the tax credit to help us in Oregon continue this great endeavor of building safe housing for our families and our children. So with that, I yield to my friend Alberto.
Thank you, Eduardo. As always, we are happy to have you as a champion on behalf of these children. We thank you for your many years of service. Chair Tomei, it is my distinct pleasure to be with you today. Members of the committee, thank you for allowing and carving out this time on what is otherwise a beautiful and glorious Friday outside. I shouldn't remind you of that because you limit my testimony even further.
Su nombre.
Yes, thank you. I was about to get to that. Thank you, Representative Gallegos. I have an entire script that is accidental to all of this today, but let me try to get in there. My name is Alberto Moreno. I am the Executive Director for the Oregon Latino Health Coalition. I'm also the President of the Board for the Oregon Farmworker Ministries. I share that with you because I think it's relevant. And I'm also a commissioner on the Governor's Commission for Hispanic Affairs and most relevant, the former director for migrant health for the state of Oregon. I share that with you because I want you to know that all of me is here on behalf of this issue, that there is not a part of me that is divided on our need to do this. But in my role as a migrant health coordinator, my office commissioned what's called the Oregon Enumeration Study, which tells us that there are 176,000 migrant and seasonal farm workers and children in the state of Oregon. We know also that these workers contribute over $5 billion in annual agricultural economic activity to our great state. And yet, as you've heard here today, this highly productive workforce does not enjoy the same protections under the law. Migrant children, for example, have a 25% higher mortality rate, which means in the simple and unadorned vernacular of our lives, that 25% more of our children are dying. Additionally, farm workers are among the most disadvantaged, medically indigent persons and have the poorest health of any group. For example, commonly reported health problems among farm workers and their children include lower height and weight, higher rates of respiratory disease, higher rates of parasitic conditions, skin infections, chronic diarrhea, vitamin A deficiency, accidental injury, heat-related illness, and chemical poisoning, to name just a few. Because of unsafe and crowded housing conditions, farm workers face tuberculosis rates which are 6 times greater than the general population. In view of these cumulative health burdens, it is appropriate for us on this sunny day to ask, what is the cost of these health inequities on a human frame? That is, what is the cost of these inequities on a human life? The answer lies in the fact that the life expectancy of farm workers is 49 years of age. 49 years compared to 73 years of life for you and me. So what is the human cost of these injustices? I would suggest to you that it's 24 years of a human life multiplied 176,000-fold across our great state. Now, you may be asking yourselves, in view of these lived reality, why do we continue to come here? It's a relevant question. We come here because we believe in the promise of this great state, a promise that is carved in the very walls of the state capital, the promise that Oregon's resources shall be justly apportioned for all. It is, I would suggest, a promise unabridged. The great stones into which it is carved are silent. Silent on color, silent on creed, silent on national origin, and silent on occupation. We are here, therefore, in this time in Oregon's history because we believe in this great state and its promise for equality for all. We ask that you join us in supporting and extending this vital tax credit on behalf of farm workers. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. That's an incredible statistic. The life expectancy is 49 years old. Would that be true for children who are born into a family of farm workers?
We hope that the same unfortunate trend does not hold for them. Chair Tomei, we have no way of knowing at this point. We know that by the time they graduate from elementary school, they've attended as many as 5 different schools. We know that they face social, linguistic, cultural, geographic isolation, and that affects their ability to get to the doctor, that affects their ability to get the right kind of education, which, as we know, is a great equalizer for all of our children in this nation and in this state. And so we hope that that reality does not hold true for them, but I cannot with any authority or certainty say to you that that is not true for them.
Thank you. Representative Olson.
Actually, I was pointing down there.
Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you very much, gentlemen, for sharing these perspectives with us. I do have one question, Mr. Moreno. I'm reading over the bill, and it makes reference to this housing being available for agricultural workers, including those who may be disabled or retired. And while I'm not opposed to that, I'm trying to understand a little better, because I would expect that retired or disabled individuals would not be as migrant as younger families who are searching for work, and I'm trying to understand the relationship. And since the problem is a limited amount of housing, do retired people or disabled people who are more stable have an effect on the younger families that are moving around and also searching for housing?
Chair, if I may, Representative Gomberg.
Announce your name.
Oh, sorry, Peter Heenley, CASA of Oregon. The reason that is in there is because the federal definition that we're often using these funds for calls out disabled and retired farm workers. And so the federal definition specifies that if you've worked for a certain number of years in the fields and then retire, then you're able to basically continue to be called a retired farm worker, and therefore you can live in the housing that the feds have set aside for this. Does that answer your question?
Well, it answers the why, and I appreciate that. And I'll say again, I'm not opposed to the idea, but I'm trying to understand the relationship between younger migrant families and perhaps less transitional retired individuals with a limited amount of housing.
Chair Tomei, Representative Gomberg, Peter Heenley again. That's a tough one to answer. In this state, we have not done a specific project geared for farm workers, retired farm workers or disabled farm workers. They are in various projects around the state. Now, you're not going to see, when we do migrant housing, you know, you're typically setting aside a handicapped units because it's required, but you're not specifically designing and building the housing for those folks. It's made available for them. And I still don't know if I'm getting at your...
Could I
Representative Gallegos?
Yeah, maybe another way to look at this is are there parameters that define migrant specifically, and what might those be?
Which... Chair Tomei, well, Representative Gallegos, there are numerous definitions,
yeah.
And I think you heard a little bit of a discrepancy when he said 167,000 and I said 150,000, because processing workers qualify as farm workers for certain things. Head Start has a definition of migrant, the other programs. So,
I guess I was trying to help Representative Gomberg's question.
I don't know that I will have greater luck than you have.
Announce your name again, please.
Of course, Alfredo Moreno with the Oregon Latino Health Coalition. I think Peter is absolutely right. I think the nuance in all of this is that we have to think of these individuals as being a part of families. And so, as you know, we come from a great tradition where we value our families, and often our communities are multi-generational households. And so that means that within our households we'll have children as young as Peter's, even younger still, and that we will have, because we value them, our grandparents, and in some instances even our great-grandparents with us. That is the strength of who we are. That is the strength of who we are as a community. And so it means to us that often we cohabitate. We inhabit spaces too small for our robust and vital and thriving families. And among those, I would suggest can and are included some of these disabled individuals.
Excellent. I appreciate that explanation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Any further questions? Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's our last. With that, colleagues, we will be bringing this back for a work session hopefully next week. And if you have any questions, please approach one of us, the vice chair or the chair or Representative Unger. With that, I will close first public hearing on House Bill 2980 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2474. Is that right? Okay, go ahead. House Bill 2474. There's a revenue statement issued. It may have a fiscal impact statement. That statement has not yet been issued. It extends the sunset for tax credits relating to farm worker housing ownership or operation to 2020. Includes funding for construction and rehabilitation of farm worker housing.
Great. Do we have anybody who's speaking on that?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay, so this is very similar?
Yes.
Okay.
Sorry.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is the companion bill to 2980. This is the bill that was introduced by the governor's office through the Department of Revenue. It was a strict reauthorization.
Doug, could you identify?
Yes, Doug Riggs, Oregon Opportunity Network. Sorry about that. We're very pleased that the governor submitted the bill. It did not include a definitional change and a name change for the program. And this was something that we spent quite a bit of time on in the work group a year and a half ago with all the agencies, all the stakeholders. One of the things we were tasked by Senator Burdick and Representative Barnhart was to try to identify changes that would bring the program into the 21st century. Part of that is making sure it aligns with federal definitional changes, which include food processing and food storage as possible avenues. And so we all felt collectively that agricultural workforce more aptly described the intent of the program and lined it better up with federal statutes. So 2474 is a great bill. We think 2980 is a slightly better bill. And so if we passed 2980 and passed it on to the Joint Tax Credits Committee, I think all of us would be happy with that.
Great. Thanks for that explanation. I appreciate that. Any questions? With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2474 and open up the first public hearing on House Bill 2316. Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2316 has a revenue statement issued, no fiscal impact. It excludes the pension income from lower income household and net worth definitions relating to individual development accounts.
Great. And we have people wanting to testify there. So Janet Bird, Megan Muller, and Lena Green. Welcome back.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Janet Bird, and I'm the Executive Director of Neighborhood Partnerships. You often see me with my other Housing Alliance convener hat on, but today you get to see me in my other role. Neighborhood Partnerships is the manager on behalf of the State of Oregon of the Oregon Individual Development Account Initiative, and I'm going to just give you a brief description of the initiative and walk you through the statutory change that we're requesting, and then these lovely ladies have personal experiences that they'd like to share that illustrate the need for the statutory change. But we also are aware that it's Friday afternoon, so we're all prepared to be brief.
Thank you.
So the Oregon IDA Initiative, Individual Development Account Initiative, builds financial resilience and creates pathways of opportunity for Oregonians with low incomes. And we believe that this is important, you know, as folks get the opportunity to be part of the middle class, to build resilience and prosper. We think that our whole community thrives and benefits from that. And so we're really excited to be here to share this. Individual development accounts are matched savings accounts. Individuals with low incomes from all over Oregon work in their communities with organizations that offer them financial education and skills specific to their savings goals. And then as folks save and reach their goals in terms of building a business plan, et cetera, their savings are matched with resources from the Oregon IDA Initiative. The initiative was created by the legislature in 1999. It's interesting to go back to that original statute and find that the goals that were established in statute are still the goals that we very much support today, and those are written in my testimony for you. But they call out that it is the state's role to try to build family economic well-being and to create an asset-based anti-poverty strategy, which this very much is. So there are two pieces of statute that are most relevant for the initiative. ORS 458-670 sets out the goals for the initiative and puts a framework around operations. There's also ORS 315-271, and that creates the funding mechanism for the initiative. It creates a state tax credit of 75% on contributions that come into the designated organization, which is Neighborhood Partnership. We then take that resource that's generated from the marketing of the tax credits, and we allocate it out to a network of about 100 partners total through 9 organizations. And in your packet, there's a cute little diagram that illustrates all of that, which I won't walk you through right now, but if there are questions, I'd be happy to address. There's also, just for your reference, a 2-page background sheet on the initiative in your packets. It describes the breadth and scope of the initiative. We are operative in 32 of the 36 counties in the state. We work very, very hard to reach all communities and provide this opportunity to individuals throughout the state. And we have worked since 2008 with Portland State University's Regional Research Institute to do an independent evaluation of the initiative. So on that 2-pager, it calls out some of the results of that evaluation. Those reports are also available on the internet. But we see from that evaluation real immediate benefit, but also long-term benefit and changes in the financial behavior of participants, which we're really excited about. So the purpose of House Bill 2316, and we are submitting amendments, which I believe you have in front of you. I hope you have in front of you. The purpose is to make a pretty simple change to statute. It does not increase the cost of the initiative. What it does is it changes the definition of who is eligible to participate. And again, the two lovely ladies with me will talk specifically about that issue. What we have in statute currently is that individuals who are eligible to participate have to be low income, have to have low incomes, and there's an asset limit of $20,000, not including a home and a first vehicle. What we found is that many potential participants who are very low income have some pension holdings, particularly with pensions now being controlled by individuals more than by the corporations that folks work for forever. And so we would like to exclude $60,000 from the asset limit test. It wouldn't affect the income test. The income limits, people would still be low income, but it would affect the asset calculation. And again, this would not increase the total cost to the state, it would just increase the number of individuals that would be eligible to be served by our partners. There'd still be the cap on the absolute cost of the initiative. And I just wanted to call out one last thing that's in your packet. There's a pamphlet that's prepared by one of our national partners, the Corporation for Enterprise Development, which does a lot of work, and if you need a little bedtime reading, there's a lot of data in there about the importance of building household financial resilience. We work with them on setting state policy priorities, and they did agree with us that this increase in asset limits was a priority. So you'll see that called out in that information. So I'd be happy to address any questions about the operations or scope of the initiative. Thank you very much.
Why don't we hear from these young women, and then we'll take questions, because these women may answer our questions before we have a chance to ask them. So thank you, Janet. Go ahead.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, thank you for letting me speak with you this evening. My name is Morgan Miller. I'm a freshman at Roseburg High School in Roseburg, Oregon. I come from an average middle-class family with the car, the house, the two dogs, cats, and everything but the white picket fence. My parents made an ambitious decision when I was young to have me and my sister attend college debt-free. That meant a lot of budget cuts, which also meant cutting out dance, which was my favorite hobby. I love dance so much that I told my parents, I'll pay for it myself. I now pay an annual $1,500 fee for my dance. Then the recession hit, which made it even harder to pay for dance. The only casualties was my college fund. That was when we met Rebecca from our local IDA program. Because of private funding that did not have net worth limits, we were able to participate in the youth program from 2 years ago. We used the money to pay for dance classes and even get a new laptop for my college education. My whole family was excited to get started in the college savings plan. We were finally going to get back on track for my future. Unfortunately, we did not qualify for the college program. Even though my parents' income had been greatly diminished, we had too much money in our retirement accounts. The proposed change that we are discussing today, the House Bill 2316, would have allowed me and my sister to participate in this IDA program. The funds would have been a huge blessing to my family, and I would have been on my way to becoming an English teacher. I will forever be grateful for the financial skills that I have learned in this IDA youth program. I will remember the feeling of accomplishment. I was empowered. I knew that confidence from that moment on would achieve anything that I set my mind to. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you, Megan.
Chair Tomei and committee members, first of all, Chair Tomei, thank you for calling me a young woman, young lady. I appreciate that. My name is Lena Green. I'm a member of the Klamath Tribes, and I work at an organization in Portland called the Native American Youth and Family Center. Some of you may know of us as NAYA Family Center. NAYA Family Center provides culturally specific wraparound social services, also educational and community development programming for over 1,400 youth and their families from over 380 tribal backgrounds annually. NAYA was started 30 years ago by Portland Native parents concerned about their children's welfare and future. And many of those parents that started NAYA 30 years ago are now our revered and treasured elders in our community. And they're who I would like to speak with you about today. But first, I'd like to let you know that at NAYA, we do have a robust IDA program and a homeownership program. And we're continually striving with that program to support our community in their dreams and goals of homeownership, post-secondary education, and starting small businesses. And in an effort to expand our reach of our programming, in the spring of 2011, we organized a project called Sharing Our Stories of Home. And we brought together many of our community elders to share about their feelings and thoughts and memories of home, to also talk to us about their desires and their wishes for programming to support them. Our elders told us about, they shared with us about the importance of having home, of owning a home. And I don't know if you know in the Native community, but it's kind of a big deal when we have a home in our community. And they talked about how it was important for bringing our families together, for sharing and practicing our cultural ceremonies, for being safe and secure. They also talked about how owning a home had brought financial stability to their families. We also heard stories, and they reminded us of how they had struggled and scrimped and saved and sacrificed to purchase their homes, and how they'd worked their entire lives to maintain them and the pride of doing that. They shared with us their desires to pass their homes on to their families and their children. And they shared their concerns about, were they going to be able to retain their homes as they aged? We heard what they said, and we thought about that. And we said, how can we address this? So we thought, we'll start an IDA program that will help our elders save to make these necessary repairs to stay in their home. With the help of neighborhood partnerships, we're able to start offering that program at NAYA Family Center. And it was very exciting in the community, and we had a lot of interest. Elders were lined up because they had pressing repairs needed to their homes and things that they needed to do to help with accessibility. So we started taking our elders through the application process, and then wham, we hit the wall of the $20,000 asset limit. Many of our elders, over their lifetimes, have practiced wise financial behaviors. They have small and meager pensions that put them over that $20,000 asset limit and disqualify them from participating in the program. And really what that means is that most likely they won't be able to make those repairs and those improvements to accessibility without the help of the IDA. So I'm here today to ask you to help us with changing that asset limit. It would greatly enable us to support our loved and beloved elders and helping them to age in place and stay in their homes, keep those homes in our communities. They work so hard for them. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Now, questions. I think Representative Whitsett had been first, and then Representative Gelser.
Thank you. Is there an upper age limit? I see the lower age limit is 12.
Chair Tomei, Representative Whitsett, no, there is not an upper age limit within the IDA initiative.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am really impressed that you pay for your dance lessons, Morgan, and I was wondering how you earn the money to pay for your lessons.
I do about 8 fundraisers in a year at about the same time. I find various jobs anywhere I can find them. It's basically scrounging the entire year, but I somehow get it done.
Follow up. And what kind of dance do you do?
For the last 4 years, I've been doing ballet. I've been dancing for 11 years. 7 years, when I first started, for 7 years, I did all kinds of dance. I was on a team, and we just did whatever we felt like.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you. Janet, I just want to make sure I totally understand this. So all this bill does, it extends the tax credit. We're not really voting on that. It's already. Does it have a sunset?
Yes. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, the tax credit authorization sunsets in 2016. So we're not really doing with that.
Okay.
This is just the change on the statutory programmatic side of the IDA initiative.
So that people's pensions can not be included in their net worth.
Correct. It just changes the calculation of net worth.
Great.
And if I may, Chair Tomei, we realize that we need one additional amendment. We are worried that the word pension may be undefined, and so we've asked for an amendment that would allow pension to be defined in administrative rule. Okay. And so we'll be coming back to you with that amendment hopefully next week sometime. I mean, it should be ready soon, and right, whenever you're able to hear it.
Good. That's great. Representative Whitsett.
I have one more question.
Sure.
So is the tax credit the same as the matching 3-to-1 funds?
So on the little diagram, what it shows is contributors make contributions to neighborhood partnerships or to the Oregon IDA initiative. They receive a 75% tax credit. Those funds that come into the initiative are allocated out to partner organizations across the state, and those funds provide the match to the individuals who save.
Okay.
Follow up?
Yeah. So does the state of Oregon, do the taxpayers from the state of Oregon contribute at all to this plan?
Chair Tomei, Representative Whitsett, the state provides the 75% tax credit, and that is what funds the initiative. So contributors to the initiative deduct 75% of their contribution from their state taxes.
Okay. So in a sense, there is a state contribution because people aren't paying the taxes. They're only paying a quarter of their taxes on that amount that they have donated. Am I correct in that?
Okay.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there a federal match in this program?
Chair Tomei, Representative Kenny Geyer, there is a federal program that is a parallel, the Assets for Independence program, and many of our partner organizations also receive federal grant. The state resource makes us very competitive. The last time we calculated, Oregon had received about 10% of total allocations of that federal pot of money because people were able to use the state program as match. Neighborhood partnerships also now is an Assets for Independence grantee, so for some of the smaller partners, we provide their ability to use that match as well.
And is the criteria for eligibility the same for that program?
Chair Tomei, Representative Kenny Geyer, our program is more liberal than the federal program. And so in 2007, there was a change made to the Oregon IDEA statute that allows youth ages 12 to 18 to participate. That's different than the federal statute. The other different primary differences are that we do allow the home repair IDEA. That's distinct from the federal program. And we allow individuals to save for technology that would support an employment goal. So, for example, an assisted speaking device or something like that.
Sorry. Sure, I have another one. So how much Oregon tax is not being collected for the general fund, I would assume, by this program?
The Chair Tomei, Representative Whitsitt, it is $7.5 million in 2012.
And a $10 million max, right?
Correct.
Okay. So, and that's, it's $10 million every year, right?
That is correct. Okay. Chair Tomei.
So with the minors, are their eligibility is because of their parents? Like with the minors, because her parents might have more than $60,000?
Yeah. So Chair Tomei, Representative Kenny Geyer, we look at household income. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we would not necessarily want to open this up to every youth 12 and over who might have particularly affluent parents. We do want the program to be means tested, so we do look at household income definition as a category.
The pension would refer to their parents.
Correct.
No problem.
Thank you. How will you decide, since you're opening this up quite a bit more, who will be the recipients of this? I would anticipate that you'll have a greater demand than you have the $10 million a year. So how will you determine who's going to get the money?
Chair Tomei, Representative Whitsitt, it's a very good question. So we do look as an initiative at trying to prioritize certain populations. We look very closely at the demographics of the initiative, the geographic spread, and we've worked very hard to get into communities that are economically disadvantaged. So we've worked very hard to work in rural communities, some of the hard-hit areas such as Douglas County, for example. The same organization that works in Douglas County has also worked very hard in Klamath County to work with partners. We work in to get into communities of color and with partners who are serving underserved populations. So it's in the funding allocation process. Partners come to us and tell us which, us and Housing and Community Services, and tell us which groups and populations they're trying to serve, what their program goals are. And that's how the boundaries are put around applications.
Hello. For example, the elderly, do you anticipate doing a lottery or something in terms of deciding when you have, you know, when people understand that have these pensions that no longer counts, you're probably going to get a lot of applications from the elderly for things like repairing their homes and things like that. Do you have some system in mind of what you're going to do? Because the elderly is a little different population than what you're talking about otherwise by race, et cetera. I mean, that covers everything.
Mm-hmm. Chair Tomei, Representative Whitsitt, people access the IDEA program primarily through community partners that they're working with. And so I think particularly with the home repair IDEA, which I think is where elderly populations or elderly individuals would be drawn, they would work with an organization that would look, you know, similar to what NAIA Family Center spoke about, you know, what are the community goals, which communities are they really trying to stabilize. And then I think we just would have, you know, many of our programs operate now with waiting lists, and so we would just have to add people to a waiting list.
One more question. Thank you. So how many people had IDEA accounts through your program in the last year?
Chair Tomei, Representative Kenny Geyer. You know, I should be better at remembering numbers, but it is on that lovely two-pager that I handed you. Jeff, I think I believe we have 2,400 Oregonians are currently saving and working with an initiative partner.
Okay, thank you. 2,400, and that would be 10 million a year, right?
7.5 million this past year.
Yeah, Chair Tomei, Representative Kenny Geyer. People save for extended periods of time, and so we typically open up about 1,500 new accounts a year, but people will save for a period of several years often.
Okay. Any further questions? This is fascinating. I don't think I'd ever known anything about this before.
I'm sorry, I keep that every time you answer. I have another question. Is there a limit on the number of years or the amount that they can tap into on the 1 to 3?
Chair Tomei, Representative Kenny Geyer. There is a statutory limit of $3,000 a year in match, mm-hmm. $20,000 a year per household. So that's the statutory limit. In reality, those limits are not reached or not touched. Our program partners simply, for the cost of working with individuals, they try to set a time period of about 3 years that most people are saving. That's changed with the youth IDA. Some of the youth IDA programs have folks saving longer. We, as a program administrator, try very hard to give our partners the flexibility to design programs that work with the communities that they're trying to reach. So, there is some variation in that. We also find a lot of variation. This maybe stop me if I'm getting into too much detail. We see a lot of variation. Folks that are saving for a small business or a micro enterprise, they typically save shorter periods of time. Folks that are saving for education or a home may save longer.
Representative Gunberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the families that qualify for this program are those that are operating at either 80% of the median family income in an area or 200% of the federal poverty guidelines. It's hard to imagine a family in those criteria putting away $20,000 a year. What's the average amount that is going into these accounts?
Chair Tomei, Representative Gunberg, I'm sorry, I must have been unclear. People typically save closer to like $1,000 a year. The $20,000 is the asset limit on households.
Okay. Oh, I thought that was the cap
and
on the match
the cap
for
on
the family.
Lifetime. It's the cap on lifetime.
Lifetime, not annual.
Correct.
And is $3,000 the cap on the annual?
Yes.
Okay.
Any further questions? Very interesting. Thank you so much for coming and bringing this bill before us today. And thanks for coming. And good luck on your savings for your college education. Thank you so much.
I'm sure Representative Geltzer would agree with me. We've seen some remarkable young people testifying in committees this afternoon.
Yes. Oh, from your previous committee.
That's right.
Why did you give me that?
Oh, I just wanted to make sure that.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. With that, we will close the first public hearing on House Bill 2316 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2388.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2388 has no revenue impact and a fiscal impact was issued. It is a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. It appropriates $100,000 from the general fund to the Oregon Department of Administrative Services for establishment of a revolving loan fund to aid housing development for veterans or domestic violence victims.
Thank you. This is regarding Oxford Houses, right?
This
you didn't
regarding
mention that.
Oxford
right.
Houses, that's
okay.
Correct.
All right. We have anyone here to testify. We see we do. Welcome. If you would just announce what your name is, that would be terrific.
Madam Chair, committee. My name is Nancy Klein, and I represent the Recovery Association Project, or RAP. I would like to thank you for this opportunity to talk about the Oxford model and RAP's efforts to expand that model to provide housing for other at-risk populations. This is not about Oxford Houses of Oregon. This is about housing at-risk populations using the model that Oxford has pioneered. I come to this program not as a person in recovery from substance abuse, but as someone who has been trying to solve the housing problem for domestic violence survivors for a long time. Housing for those who have left a domestic violence environment is a severe problem. I was on the Clackamas Women's Services Board for 6 years. CWS has 38 beds for a county with 350,000 people. According to a DHS report, in 2011, there were 20,681 requests for shelter that could not be met in the state of Oregon. At CWS, we could not only not meet the need, but shelter beds are so expensive, we could never increase the number of beds. In the meantime, shelter stays were lengthening because women had no place else to go. There is a huge need for transitional/permanent housing. 2 years ago, RAP was faced with multiple requests for housing of domestic violence survivors in need of housing, but who could not be accommodated in Oxford housing because the survivor was not dealing with substance abuse. In fact, I had the head of the shelter at the YWCA say to me, "Sometimes I pray my women are addicts so I can move them into an Oxford house." We were also faced with helping women in the Oxford system who were dealing with the trauma of domestic violence. 76% of the women in the Oxford system are domestic violence abusers or survivors. It was at that point that we wondered if we could broaden the Oxford model to provide low-income housing that was affordable for the community for other at-risk populations. To do this, RAP took its 8 years of experience working with the Oxford system and went to experts in other fields. For example, a committee was formed on domestic violence with representatives from shelters and other providers. We tweaked the model to better meet the needs of the DV community and opened up a demonstration project. Since then, we have opened up 12 houses. We are presently housing 96 people, women, in the metro area and their children. There are 5 homeless women and children houses that we have opened up with Multnomah County. These are women who were in warming shelters and had no place else to go. We have 5 domestic violence houses, and we just took over running the Yolanda House from the YWCA because the YWCA could no longer afford to run that as a shelter. The Oxford system has some distinct advantages, and I want everybody to be clear. I'm talking about the model, not the organization.
Thank you.
Okay. It is affordable from the point of view of public dollars. It costs about $400 per year per bed. It is low income. The average house member spends between $380 and $420 a month, depending on where a house is located. And that includes rent, it includes utilities, it includes common household goods, such as coffee, tea, toilet paper, and $15 that goes into the system to support the system a month. It provides a comprehensive peer-mentored program of self-help and life skills. It helps people who have already suffered severely from isolation, which is particularly true with domestic violence survivors, to form a community of people with shared experience. Sharing a community of peers is self-healing. Shared experience forms a deep bond of understanding. This has been how the AA model works. All peer mentoring programs work on this principle. It is very powerful to be taken by the hand by one of your housemates and told, "Come on in. We understand. I'll ride the bus with you. And come to this support meeting with me." Links are provided to appropriate support organizations, whether for support for mental health issues, employment, or trauma. I would like to take just a minute to tell you a story about community in a house. Our first domestic violence house was in Clackamas County. Our houses are alcohol and drug free, and that was a decision that we kind of went back and forth on because there's this feeling that domestic violence survivors are adult women who should be able to have a glass of wine. But the head of the Clackamas Women's Services went back into her shelter and asked the women there what they thought about this and was told, many of us are in early recovery and we're not feeling supported in our recovery. So the house started out with the idea that on premise it would be alcohol and drug free, but if a woman wanted to go home and have a glass of wine with her family, she could. Unfortunately, one of the women came back in a severely blind, excuse the term, blind drunk state, triggering trauma in the entire rest of the house. And the house then voted democratically to not allow alcohol and drugs in the house. Shortly after that, one of the other women relapsed in the house. What to do? The house with that woman determined that she needed to go back through detox and treatment. She had two small children in the house. The house also voted to keep those children in the house. They did not have to go back into foster care. The house worked with the DHS case manager. There was also a tribal case manager involved. The house worked with both case managers to maintain stability for those children while their mother went back through treatment for recovery. That is the kind of community we work to build within our houses. How does the Oxford model work? And I know we are sort of limited for time. I don't know how much detail you want me to go into. I would be happy to do that, but I think I'll let you ask me questions.
Good idea.
So, I would like to introduce to you a house member, and I'll let her introduce herself, actually.
Hi, Chair and Committee. My name is Jordan Ezell, and I'm a current member of WAP Housing, and as of April 4th, I will be there for 18 months. April 29th, I will have 4 years in sobriety from all of my altering substances. And I am a single mother of three children who I do not have in my custody because of my drug addiction and my experience with domestic violence and the issues that I have struggled with on continuing to go back to my abuser has cost me being a mother of my children and then being a product of the system. I am currently working towards getting my daughter back, who is 3 years old, and RAP has provided very stable housing for me because I am in the lower poverty. I don't get welfare, and I have disabilities that keep me from working, but I am not on disability. So it makes it very difficult for me to pay my rent. When I moved into RAP, they had subsidy for me and was able to pay my rent for me. And during this time, I have gone to college. I've been going to college the entire time I've been there. I have A's and B's. I have an average of a B average. I am chair for chapter, and so I get to work within the homes and help direct women and their children on being able to make stronger decisions for them and their children's futures. There's so much more I could tell you about myself, but RAP has helped me, and I also, because they were willing to help me with my rent, I was able to pay off my debt to society. All of my bills have been paid. I have been able to pay restitution from when I stole cars when I was 18. I am completely a part of a society of, I'm a member of society today, and I'm a role model. And WAP has really helped me do that. I do want to touch note a little bit on the experience as being chapter chair and being allowed to work within other homes that I don't live in. There is a woman that called us from Florida this last week, and in utter desperate need of housing to get away from her abuser with her four-year-old child. She found welts on her four-year-old child, and she grabbed a duffel bag and packed it and went to a domestic violence shelter. As chapter, we keep in close contact with the Women's Crisis Line here in Portland, Oregon, Multnomah County, and she was able to get a hold of that crisis line, and they directed her to me. And so I received this phone call in the afternoon, and this woman was desperate to fly completely on the other side of the country to get away from her abuser. Because we do the Democratic voting and we let people in the House because it has to be unanimous agreement. We can't just give somebody housing. But what we can do is we can give them a place to sleep for a few nights while we can get them interviews in the homes. And I told her, go ahead and buy a plane ticket and come here. I will pick you up and we will give you somewhere to sleep until we can get you housing. This woman cried, made me cry. And it was just amazing to be able to provide that for her. Wednesday, I was able to give her an emergency interview over the phone. She had already bought her plane ticket, not knowing exactly where she was going, and that house ended up voting her in. So Tuesday, when I pick her up from the airport, she will have housing. She's on disability. She can afford full rent. But because we have subsidy, we are able to pay her rent for a few months, and she can make that duffel bag be a full wardrobe for her daughter and herself, and she can get cleaning supplies but personal hygiene and grow from that, because we are able to pay her rent for the next couple of months and get a build a life in Oregon.
Thank you,
Nancy.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing your story with us. Any quick questions? Have we lost her? What's it? Okay, I couldn't see you.
Thank you both for your very compelling stories. I noticed the amendment switches the revolving loan from the Oxford House to WRAP, so I wondered if you could just explain that.
Yes, Chairman Tomain and Representative Kenyon Geyer. The original, there's so much confusion between Oxford Houses and the Oxford model for obvious reasons. And Oxford Houses of Oregon only deals with addiction.
I see.
They will not deal with non-addicted.
I see.
And their funding, they have a revolving loan fund, but it can only be used for addiction.
See. Okay, thank you. I get it. So this would be for WRAP in order to do a Oxford model program of housing.
Good. Right.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Thank you. Glad you came
Madam
today.
Madam Chair.
I'm going to close the public hearing and open a work session on 2388. When we heard this, I don't know however long ago, when was that? When did we last hear it, Regina?
That's
13th of February, I see it here. Right. It was rather confusing testimony, and I wasn't sure really what it had to do with women who are leaving a domestic violence situation. I think we have a clearer picture today. We know this is not the kind of housing that includes treatment, and we've heard some of the people who work with domestic violence treatment. They just want to make it clear that this does not have a treatment component. I think we need to be clear about that. But I think what it does offer is a unique opportunity for women who might not be eligible for a treatment setting, or there might be a waiting list. We know there are many more women who are waiting for a treatment setting than we have slots for. So I'd like to move this bill today.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Okay, I move to adopt the -1 amendments dated 3713 to House Bill 2388.
Representative Olson moves to adopt the -1 amendment dated 3713 to House Bill 2388. Any discussion? Any objection? The -1 amendment is adopted.
You Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2388 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Olson moves House Bill 2388 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I just want to say thank you, Nancy. This is a great investment, I think, and you've worked hard, so thank you.
Any further discussion or questions? All right. Debbie, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Gallegos?
Yes.
Representative Yeltsin?
Yes.
Representative Gilliam?
Excused.
Representative Kinney-Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Wiseman?
Excused.
Representative Whitsitt?
Aye.
Representative Vice Chair Gomberg?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Tomei?
Aye. The motion passes. Representative, would you carry this bill for us?
We have to adopt. It's in done Ways and Means.
Oh, right, you're there, right. So, yeah. Right. Okay. Your excuse. With that, okay, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2388.
We did. Yeah, we did. Yeah.
Okay. And any other business before the House? All right. With that, we close the House Committee on Human Services and Health.
Wonderful weekend.
Yeah, you too.